dry with the sun back then. Then they would bring them in tubs. And most of the families back then, my understanding, each had stores. I think Andy's family had a store. Our family had a store. And they would take the shrimp and go to the market in New Orleans with the dried shrimp and trade it for the other items that they would bring back down to sell in the stores. But when the fishermen would bring the shrimp in, they didn't have currency back then. It was tokens. So each one would have the tokens to bring to supply so that their family could eat, drink, and stuff for them. So, and that's how it supposedly started back in the...
Have you ever seen one of the tokens?
Yeah, we have some. My dad has some. We actually looked at it not long ago. He must have it in a safety deposit box or something. We was going through when my grandfather died. We went through it. And my grandfather had some.
At some point, I'd like to come and take a photograph of only one. They're an important part of the story that we don't want to lose. Now, when there is an Odomaw that was the president of UL, and he is also Ray Odomaw, and I know his family was in the shrimp drying business. Are you probably related, because I think it was at Robinson Canal?
It's possible.
Okay. All right.
I don't know, because don't really know of any Odomaws from Robinson Canal from back then.
Well, this would be about 1910.
But the story was when my great-grandfather came, which was in the 1800s.
Okay.
He came over with, they had two brothers.
All right.
One settled in Texas, and the other one settled closer in Lafourche, by Lafourche, going further east. Now, they do have Odomaws everywhere today, and they do have different families of them, so...
All right, now, how did all of this develop?
This all developed from that, from him starting way back in. He ended up having, I'd have to count, I don't remember off the top of my head, 8, 9 brothers, us, kids. And each kid took a different part of the industries. But to go back, they got into the canning industry. What happened, every area when the canning started in Dulac, how it was, and probably other areas, every shrimp factory had a store, had an ice house, had each thing for the area, because they didn't have much transportation. So one of his kids ran the store, one of his kids ran the ice house, one of his kids ran the shrimp factory. And as it went down, the canning started. That we was in the canning industry probably in the 20 to 30 year range when the canneries just went out of business.
What years would that be?
Roughly. Again, it started before I was born, which I was born in 70.
Okay.
But I do know that the canneries went out in the early 80s.
Okay.
The cans would
the
come.
The last ones.
Yeah, the last.
It started folding in the late
60s. Late 70s.
Late
60s. 67.
Early 70s.
Yeah.
I remember the plant when I was
Our family went out, it would have been the early 80s. We were probably one of the last ones, just because we was oldest, biggest. And they had some good backing with some of the older guys. The Schmettas in New Orleans was good friends with our family. You know, they made the machines, well, one of the makers. Latrim had some and Schmettas had some. But at that time, that's when the revolution of the refrigeration came in. Around that same time. So the guys that stuck it out and tried to go into the peeling and freezing block frozen, that part, them businesses continued. At that time, we probably had 12, 15 canning plants in Dulac.
Terrebonne Parish, yeah, there was.
And a lot of them did transfer into the block frozen.
Now, you said 20 years. Would it be before World War II or after World War II?
After. Yeah. Again, World War II was before my time. So.
Yeah, but that played a very important role in your business.
Yeah, it did. My grandpa was, he went to World War II, and he was fortunate enough that when he was getting to where he had to be stationed, the war was called off. So he was a... He watched the POWs for a while. I think that's all he had to do in it. So he was one of the fortunate ones.
In Louisiana? Or?
No, he went overseas.
Okay.
But to get back to the can, so What happened with the Oldenmore family is each brother, once the cannon industry went kind of out, the family business turned over into the pure meat business, the block freeze. And a couple of my grandpa's brothers, which owned this plant back in the day, was Terrebonne Cannon. They ended up going into the block froze too, freeze. And so he had one brother that did it here. He owned it. My daddy ran the family owned one. He had another one open up right next door, it was Gulf Breeze. Then he had two brothers open up major ice houses, because at that point, that's when the ice really started becoming a big factor. The boats started getting bigger. They would go out more days.
What year was that roughly?
That was probably mid-70s, if I have to say, when all that started transpiring. Mid, late 70s.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Again, I was young, so I just, mm-hmm, I remember when it happened.
But those were steel boats?
A lot of steel, some woods too. Okay. You know, it was a little bit of boat.
Mm-hmm.
82, 83 was when the cannon industry completely folded. That's when it took out a lot of the peeling plants too, because what happened was a lot of them was co-owned. They would peel some days, can some days, block free some days. That was when, and then what happened was when they built the freezers, built the machines and everything for the cannon, they acquired more debt than what they had. Interest rose to 22, 23, 24% in the mid-80s. Took a lot of them out.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were, the stories you heard about canned shrimp, where did the cans come from?
They were made in this country, and my dad was, he could tell you exactly where it was. And now that was just, I was getting ready to get to that. It had got to the point, I remember that, because I remember my dad arguing with the people. It was got to the point where the shrimp coming in from overseas was cheaper with the shrimp in it than we can buy the can empty in this country. That was the major fall of the canning industry. They started selling the shelf spaces to these grocery stores, and the imports could just do it so much cheaper that we couldn't afford to buy the shelf space.
So, what is a block frozen shrimp? You said block freeze.
Yeah, that's what I showed you. It's 5 pounds in one block, 50-pound cases.
Okay. So, if I buy shrimp, the standard weight is 5 pounds?
Yes, sir.
So, it could be 5 pounds of 16s or 5 pounds of 60s? I'm making this up. It's just 5 pounds.
No, it's graded out in different sizes also.
All right.
Where cannon industry used to be small or tiny, small, yeah, small, medium, which is similar to the dry shrimp. The dry shrimp in the canneries, they basically stayed the same. Where in the pure meat and the headless market, it's sizes, mostly in group of 10s till they get bigger. Then it's like 5, like 10, 15, 16, 20, 21, 25.
Is that also referred to as the count?
The count, yeah.
Okay.
And that's in whatever you're buying. If it's peeled, it's the count of it as peeled.
Andy still is in the business of, I'm going to call it raw, frozen, block frozen. You've got out of that and are just in the drying business?
Yeah,
now?
Well, we was in it since the 80s, 82, 83. We've been peeling shrimp. This is the first year we got out of it.
So over 30 years ago.
Yeah. And my family, like I said, we've been in it family-wise. I'm a fourth generation.
So that's 100 plus years.
Yeah.
Now, how has imports hurt you?
Just can't compete with the price. I mean, when you figure in the labor, the freight, the box, everything that goes into a block of shrimp, if you got to buy it at the price it takes to buy it at, the fishermen can't make a living. I mean, if we have $3 in the item, the imports come in at $2.80. You can't make a living with it.
Now, you just mentioned to me a box. Mm-hmm. Where do you get your boxes? Andy was kind enough to give me three boxes.
Livingston Box Company makes my 5-pound boxes. St. Tammany Box Company makes my 50-pound cases.
Wow. Now, do you remember barrels, or at least stories about barrels for shrimp?
Yeah, I still do the figures on barrels of shrimp because a barrel's 210 pounds. So all my yields and percentages are figured in because that's how I grew up with the barrel. A barrel, it was 70 pounds per tub. Three tubs made a barrel, which is 210 pounds.
Is a tub sometimes referred to as a basket?
Today, yeah, but back in the day it wasn't. They didn't have baskets. They had tubs back in the day when we first started. It was a metal tub.
All right.
I don't know if I want to butt in.
No, please.
But I'm right, ain't I? No. Again, a lot of stuff I'm telling you. If he butts in and says something different, I'll probably say okay, because it's some stuff, because the tubs, I remember it when I was a kid, but again, I was 5, 6, 7 years old.
It was
similar
to the number 2 tub, but it was a little bit different.
Okay.
It was metal they'd fill up and dump it.
They didn't weigh it. You see, back in the day, they didn't weigh the shrimp.
Right.
They didn't have scales. Yeah. They went by the tub. When the tub was full, they estimated it was 70 pounds. Because they was on a they were on a platform near the Gulf.
There wasn't half.
They didn't bring the scales. They estimated it from up here, and they just said, "Look, a full tub is 70 pounds. We're gonna pay you X amount per tub. That makes 70 pounds. We figure what the yield's gonna be. So when we get it to the market, we know what the price is gonna cost us and how we make a profit."
Three tubs filled the barrel.
Three tubs filled that barrel in the market. The barrel would hold 210 pounds in the market, but you couldn't. You didn't have forklifts. So they would use it in tubs till they get to the barrel.
Now, that's a good point.
That's how I was understood.
No, that's a perfect point. The other thing is, have you ever heard of Mancuso? Is that a name you recognize?
No.
Andy? Mancuso was one of the they manufactured shrimp barrels in Houma, but largely for Bloom and Bajoran. So, at some point,
my grandfather.
My dad probably would know it, or my grandfather.
Well, I'd like to sit down and chat with your dad at some point. Mm-hmm. And the reason is, if we don't get these stories now, we're never going to get them.
Yeah.
I've retired, and I like doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And we will make a copy of this for you when we're done. But I have to cautionary note: it sometimes take a while for us to get it. But we won't. I won't allow these people to forget.
I enjoy reading some of the history books because, I say, a lot of my great-grandpa's in it, and his grandpa and great-grandpa's in it, and we enjoy the history of it, too.
Now, let's go back to something I said earlier. Of us, Natalie's the youngest.
Nicole.
Pardon?
Nicole.
I'm sorry. My brain is in a different hemisphere. But it's important for you to point out that to a certain generation, they can't appreciate how young electricity is.
You're right.
Believe it.
And so here we are, 21st century, talking to fourth generation. Can you relate any stories about the arrival of electricity in Dulac? All right, but you can tell, do you have an approximate idea when electricity? Was it pre-World War II or post-World War II?
I think it was pre-World War II.
I think it was pre. I know my grandfather was involved in the original road that came down being shelled. It was a dirt road before.
That was in the 30s, right?
Yeah. And his dad would probably know better because Mr. Raymond's in 70. He's 70.
But he was born in 40, my dad. But he know the stories. And I think when he was born, they had electricity.
How about telephone?
Again, they had some telephone, and I think it was probably early, it probably was in the 30s also, same time electricity was ran here. The stories I remember, and it might be that my dad was remembering when he was a little older, I don't remember, but they had the phones was at the stores. Like my grandpa had a phone, and they would come to use the phone there to phone home if they had an emergency and stuff like that. They had very few phones, but people would walk miles to get to that one phone or two phones to do it. And if I'd have to say, that was similar to when the roads were paved and things like that. That was
the original road.
That
was
one of the reasons
paved.
Why. Huh? No, I mean shelled. Yeah, the original road shelled.
And it was clamshell.
The pavement didn't happen until we was young, almost in the 70s.
Yeah.
Well, the reason I ask, I have an account of a load of frozen shrimp. So it was in a refrigerated truck. About 1948 to 50.
Now that refrigerated truck back then was just ice.
That's all.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And
no mechanical.
Nope. And it was carrying a load. And what they would do, they would stop at a telegraph and send a telegram back to, say, your father. And your father's job was to say, well, I just got an order at, and they had an overload. And they would use the telegraph to distribute because we don't have computers. It was the telegraph.
And it might have been telegraph instead of phone back then, just, you know.
Well, it's an important part of the distribution system.
Mm-hmm.
that we're, one of the things we're trying to do is tell the backstory. That's why I asked, where do you get your boxes? You can't function without a box. Nice. You can't function without an ice. Well, if you think of a case of canned shrimp, that's a box. I did the math, and in 1 year, if it is a 1x12, it would have stretched from New Orleans to St. Louis for just the boxes for 1 year.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
500,000 boxes, 48 cans a box, 2.5 ounces.
I mean, the warehouse that when I was a kid, we used to hide in the warehouse, me and my cousins. And it was crazy. I mean, they had them stacked up high.
That is important for us to know, yeah. Because we've become so convenient food oriented. We forget the supply chain that your families had to go through before you could get on a phone.
Mm-hmm.
So those kinds of things that you remember are important. Now let's start when you got into the business. Were your boats all steel hulled or were they wooden?
Mixture. They still a mixture today. We still have a lot of wooden boats.
Where are the wooden boats built?
Local.
Some of them built in their backyard. On the bio side, you know.
Now, what's the bio side?
Right next to the wall.
It's the bank next to the bio.
On either side?
Yeah. Either side.
All right, so you can, it is a local person who's building wooden boats.
A lot of these guys built their own boat.
In their backyard.
Well, if it's bio side, you know, I mean, it's, you know, I mean, like on the bio side, they may have to live across the road and walk over, but some guys may have to walk down to build boats, because right there by our plant where the ice plant is, they built a lot of boats there. It was an uncle that, you know, you came help him. He'd lay your keel and build the ribs. It might be a year, but they'd get a boat out, and when it's done, they'd lay one for somebody else. But
it was a family. A lot of them was family ordeals. All right, like the Wazan families, they did a bunch.
Give me some of the as they say, back names. Wazan?
Wazan's had a bunch of them.
All right. Anybody else?
Buque.
Yeah, we got Verdans, Fidges, Thibodeaux. We got a bunch of just basically everybody from Dulac. I mean, back in the day, that's all you had. We didn't have oil field.
But nobody knows that.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? So you're telling me that basically every shrimper had the capability of making his own boat, or at least getting help to build a boat.
Yeah, getting help.
Yeah.
And what was the power plant? What pushed it?
The hands.
Yeah. Yeah, so when you went motorized, was it diesel or gasoline engines?
Some of it was originally kerosene.
Do you remember?
Was kerosene.
Do you remember any of the trade names?
Oh, man. No, we were kids.
Fairbanks.
I do remember Fairbanks, have you mentioned it?
Globe.
I don't remember.
Lathrop.
Fairbanks was the only one I remember. Now you said it.
Palmer. So then, you know, when you put a motor in a boat, as I understand it, the key is putting it so the shaft is perfect so it doesn't cavitate.
Slightly. You have to have a slight angle for your engine, it's got to be straight, because if it cavitates, it's going to wear out your stuffing box.
Who learns that? How do you learn that?
You do it wrong, you sink.
Trial and error.
You do it wrong, you don't get very far down the channel.
But everybody knows everybody. So when you made a mistake, you told everybody else and it wasn't repeated. Am I fair?
Well, this was a community where you had a guy that built the boat, and he helped somebody build a boat, and then the deckhands, I mean, it was a community, everybody was involved. A lot of the original boats that we had there, you know, the crews lived within walking distance.
The boats
were
built for different things also. They'd use that same boat in the wintertime to go trapping. I mean, because down in this part, I mean, everybody did, they lived off the land, so it was a...
Were they always cypress?
I can't answer that. I think for the most part, they used what they could. A lot of them were cypress, but they found out later that the fir for the keel and stuff, they when they could get it, mm-hmm. that was a later date. But originally, they had to work with what they
I'm
had.
I'm sure, yeah. And I'm sure in the old days, most of it was cypress. Cause...
Yeah. And as far as the shrimp boats, they were all engined as best I can tell, but the oyster boats were even the schooners. Sail.
All right. Now, when they shipped... When they went to diesel, Gray Marine?
That's That's before my time.
Before me too. I mean, I couldn't tell you. I'm not a. We never was in the shrimping part of it myself. I was always the.
I've been told the next guy.
So I don't know a whole lot more about the boats.
If the wheelhouse is in the back, that was called a Biloxi. If it was on the front, it was called a Floridan. And the Floridan came from Florida, I believe, by Batu Sheremi. And that's how it got here.
Well, Batu Sheremi, my dad could tell you, you know, if it,
yeah,
knew
Batu,
he knew Batu.
Batu was...
He was well known in the business.
Yes, he was. Okay, so if you start after you were born, just explain the industry over the last 30 years. 20 years. What have you seen?
I've seen a decline in market, an increase in consumption in shrimp. It became from a luxury item when I was a kid to a commodity item today. And that, to me, that's just the whole thing about the shrimp industry. And, you know, it just made it tougher for livings. I mean, prices today are cheaper than they were when I first got in it in the 80s.
They're cheaper today than they were in the 70s.
In the 70s, yeah.
Now, Andy, you mentioned to me the amount of shrimp that's consumed. Can you repeat those numbers?
These are information we got from NOAA's numbers, that 320 million people in the country eating 4 pounds of consumption would be 1,280,000,000 pounds. The numbers calculated that the imports shipped in 2018 from January to December was 1.596 billion pounds. There was also, we produced between 180 to 200 million pounds. Our effort is down, so our poundage is down a little bit. But Mexico also had a carryover of around 180 to 200 million pounds. So if you take the 1.596 with 200 million for domestic and 200 million for the Mexican, you end up being right about 1.6 million pounds with a 1.28 billion pound consumption, which leaves you about 400 million pounds over, which is destroying the price structure. Too much of anything, it loses
supply
value.
And demand.
We've been seeing that for probably 15 years. We had started attempting, trying to get trade issues and stuff since 2001.
We've talked about it since 88.
Yeah.
But the younger guys got involved.
I think what helped us was 5-6 years ago, EMS happened. And the
EMS.
Early mortality syndrome.
From the importers.
Okay.
So it finally, for
2 years, we had a consumption level higher than the actual coming in rate. So it eased off everything. So that's why we're seeing it start to decline so quick again. We get into that margin where the inventories are really starting to be over surplus.
Well, as we mentioned before, with EMS, it disrupted the shrimp supply. Depending on which number you go to, it was 26% to 13%. So I can't tell you which one it was, but it was not a lot. A lot of guys said there was no imports in the country. That's never happened. There was only a disruption between 26 and 13%. But at that point in time, it caused our prices in a very short period of time for headless, on larger headless, to go up $2 a pound, small headless, $1 a pound, 50 cents on the peeled shrimp. So in a very, or the head-on shrimp bought for peeled shrimp. In a very short period of time, what, 90 days, 100 days, the market started fluctuating upward. And we've got back to numbers of, for a 16-20 headless, of 735. Historically, in the 70s, I remember boats got paid $9.35, and fuel was 35 cents a gallon. But we went from that $2.75, $2.85, we got it back up to the 7. It gave life back to the industry, got hope back in the industry, and a future back in the industry. The problem is, the countries that got knocked out and the price surged, the other third world countries, smaller countries, said, look, this is something we need to jump into. It's aquaculture, we can jump back into this because look at the prices. The guys that got knocked out said, look at these prices, we gotta get back in fast. So everybody globally raised their shrimp pond, you know, production, and that's what we're suffering from now. Everybody's coming in. The other thing I don't think I mentioned earlier, and this is my opinion only, but I've complained about it a whole lot. We are not competing like, you know, with India, I believe it's the Baht. Anyway, we're not competing a US dollar for US dollar. We're competing on a country that we've proven in the subsidy cases that I testified in, and that they subsidize the farmer, they subsidize the processor, they subsidize the exporter. And when they sell it, they've exchanged their dollar within their country, which has very little value outside of that country. But the U.S. dollar comes in, stays up at the top, and that's what we're fighting. They can get cheaper, because as long as their economy's moving, getting the U.S. dollar for the few at the top, we're going out. We cannot compete against that. It's more of, to me, a money laundering and money exchange situation. money manipulation. But that's what we're fighting now. So as the importers got ramped up as we're bringing in more shrimp, our prices, we kept them up about 18 months trying to hold them up. And then we started losing market share, so we had to compete. But now, whereas in the 70s, you had a 935 for a 1620 white headless, we were 735, we had been down to a 275, now we're back around $4.80 to $5 mark. That's still $2 cheaper than we were just 2 years ago. But imports are still selling to our customers at anywhere from $1.50 less, or at $4.50 at $5, we've still got to pack it, inventory it, insure it, deliver it. So they're a dollar cheaper than us now, which is holding this price down. But fuel is, probably right now it's $2.50, $2.60, maybe $2.30 a gallon. It's not as bad. But all the cost of maintaining these boats and crews and living expenses is up to 2019 levels, and we're still competing on imports that they're not competing on dollar for dollar.
I want you to go back to something you said earlier, that you have an Asian customer that your dad had, and he calls you brother.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain that relationship?
In the early 80s, when shrimp was still a luxury, before the season would open, the Asians would contact us. They preferred domestic shrimp over imported shrimp back in them days. They didn't have the imported shrimp. I shouldn't say it that far, but they would come in, and they knew what they needed for their distributions. So they would come in and more or less pre-book, pre-order, and some of them would even prepay some of the shrimp. So that went on for years and years until imports started coming in. And that was one of the biggest, I think, effects that hurt a lot of the industry. The capital it takes to run a place like we have is unbelievable. So if you had customers that was willing to pre-book, prepay, because one thing about our industry, we buy for cash and sell on credit. And in any economics course you take, that's a sure sign of a failure. I mean, ain't many industries that buy cash, sell credit, and survive. And the shrimp industry always done it.
Now,
and it started because of that, I think, because we always had some pre-hooking shrimp.
He asked the relationships that were built back then of those guys. Not only did they prepay or come, but they stayed with the
family. They would come here when the season would open because they would want to visually see the color of the shrimp, the sizes of the shrimp, to know what they were getting. The company would send one person here, and they would literally sleep at the house and come the first 4 or 5 days of the season and say, hey, we want 100,000 pounds of this or that.
100,000 pounds?
It was crazy numbers. It could be up to that, yeah.
And that goes back.
That's only three trailer loads of shrimp. I mean, it sounds like a lot.
What is a trailer load?
18-wheeler load.
An 18-wheeler load was 30,000 pounds. Back in the day, it was closer to 40,000 pounds because we didn't pack with water. We used to pack a dry pack back in the day when we first started. And that was because the shrimp would get consumed so quick because we didn't have much competition. So they would come in to buy it because they wanted to know they had it. It would get consumed. Once imports started coming into the country, we had to inventory it a lot longer. And that's when we started packing with water.
To give it shelf life.
Because we might be holding it a year if we buy it high in the market fall, we have the possibility.
So your ice house is where you hold it, or some
freezer.
Freezer is where you hold it.
Yep.
Okay.
We have a separate location that just a cold storage.
Yeah, the cans were, of course, non-refrigerated for the most part. But once we got into the block, it had to be refrigerated in a freezer-type material.
But you mentioned something about it had to look good in the freezer. That is, when you were talking about your shrimp and they lay it out as in a seafood market or grocery store now, almost everybody carries something on ice. What did you mean by that?
Well, the visual in most today when people buy it at retail, visually, if you put something that looks fresh and slick and clean, or fresh and slick is going to make it look, you know, clean, I guess, but the fresher it looks, the more appealing it is for somebody to buy that. Problem that we have with a lot of seafood, he puts out in the showcase, and they put a lot out there, it just sits there and dehydrates, and it looks rougher, and it dries out, and the shell may stick, it may, you know, lose its texture.
We went into that part to try to get into it. We out of it. We're probably going to try, and we talk about it when I get back into it. A lot of people ventured out even a little bit further, but your shelf life drops. They use it what they call an IQF shrimp, and a lot of people, it's individually quick frozen. And that's what a lot of people started going into the retail, retail markets with.
Is that also called plate frozen?
No. Plate frozen's still a block. Plate frozen's just a different... You got blast freezes, which comes down. Plate freezes is actually plates that touches the two together. And it's a quicker freeze than a blast. Mm-hmm. But it's not individual like the IQF.
The block, of course, you saw the block. We put it in a, you know, say 5 pound. It used to be a 2 pound block. It was a 1 pound block. But the five is the standard. We used to be, it was put in the box and frozen, dry packed like you talked about. Later on, it became where we would put it in the box, we'd pour a cup of water in it, stick it in the freezer, then we'd come out, we'd open the box back up, take another cup of water, splash it across the top, flip it, put it in a case. That way it had a glaze on either side, but it was still a solid block or brick. The plate is where they put it into a container of some type, and then it contacts top and bottom. And because of contact, it freezes faster. But you can't do as much, and it's more cumbersome. Whereas the blast, you know, I mean, your blast.
My blast, I can do 30,000 pounds in 24 hours, and I got three of them. So I could do 67. Actually, one do 30, one do 20, one do 15.
But so it's 100 horsepower with 4.5 foot fans, high static fans.
I can do 65,000-70,000 in 24 hours. Where a plate freezer, I have three plate freezers when they... Probably
refrigerator
size. Yeah, no, a little bit, maybe a little bit, just the size of the room for all three of them. But you can only do 300 pounds per one. So, but it does it in 8 hours.
And then the IQF is like the cryogenics, nitrogen or CO2, yeah, where they freeze it, and it's individually frozen, and then they glaze it. But one of the problems with it, each individual shrimp is in an open bag, and the benefit of it is you can open up a 20-pound bag, and if you want three shrimp, take three shrimp out. Some of the drawbacks is you have to keep it refrigerated at a certain temperature consistently, because if it thaws out, it loses its glaze, and then it sticks.
Mm-hmm.
You quite often see that in the showcases when they use them in some of the grocery stores, where people open and close the door. After a while, the shrimp's all gummed up in the side. It's thawed out and refroze, and they get black. Because of the way it's frozen and the lack of insulation around it, it's not very tolerable to temperature change. Whereas our block, inside of a bag, inside of a 5 pound box inside of a master, very tolerable.
A block could stay in a freezer for 3 years and it's still gonna look like the day you packed it. Mm-hmm. IQF, like you said, is gonna change also if you leave it even in the right temperature. In 6 months, it'll start dehydrating because of the air. So,
there's in the block, we take something out, refrigeration removes moisture. But in the block, we've got it, as I said, in a plastic bag, in a box, inside of a master. But it's also like, I used to say, like, mom would freeze, you know, fish in the old milk cart.
Yeah.
Put the fish in there and you fill up with water and stick it in there.
Yep.
So if you have moisture comes out, it comes out of the ice before it comes out of the product. IQF, once you lose the glaze, it's coming straight out of the product.
Yeah.
Now you are in the dried shrimp also.
Yes, sir.
So you have fans and boxes and circulating hot air, just like the Collinses and Price. Nobody can afford to put them out on a platform anymore.
FDA won't let you. The bird can't fly around and poop on it.
Yeah, that makes good sense.
Second thing is, a cloudy day hurt a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, because once it rained on that shrimp, it was done.
Yeah.
It was spalling. Yep. Yeah, the Collins. In fact, I'd say we one of the oldest dry shrimp people left in the business right now. The Prices don't dry anymore. He buys all his product through me right now. Terry Laprue still do a little bit, but he's just, he don't do a whole lot of it. Yeah, he just enough for local people.
Got any questions?
No, I got more of an education
today than you can out of university. and again, a lot of what we say in is stories we were told. So if you get something different fact, let me know, because I try to tell everybody. To tell people some of the stories sometime that we was told, but. You know, you might get something, and hey, it wasn't quite exactly, but I think it's close. Because I was told by different people.
Repeat your questions, because it was not
repeated. Yeah, I'm going to... We had a Don Davis glitch. I need you to repeat your name and age.
Lance Odimore.
And do you agree that this is fine to tape you, that we may use this for scholarly research, and it may in fact be used on a website that goes national?
Yeah.
Okay. Lance, can you do the same thing for me? Give me
Alan.
Yes.
It's Alan Andrew.
Okay.
They call me Andy, so it's Alan Andrew Gibson. Everybody knows me as Andy.
All right.
But yes, no problem with using anything.
All right. We're good to go.
Good to go.
Good to go.
Now, Nicole, any questions?
No. I appreciate you guys' time. Thank you for letting us come in. Yeah. I'm sure I'll have questions later, but I'm just going to call you.
Well, I would really like to come down and interview your father. And I'm fanatical in some ways about paper goods. That is, old labels.
Believe it or not, we had so many old labels and the hurricanes. We got here with Reed and Ike down here. My dad had kept all our old labels, and he could tell you different ones. My dad was a fanatic with the can. He was fanatic with the can, and he loved it, because that was kind of like his passion back in the day. And he knew all the labels. Mr. Ray Scamedanim had the labels. Bubba Ruta had the labels. They had so many different labels.
Well,
Violet was the last cannon that was still...
Bumblebee, and it got taken out by Katrina.
Right.
But what I really need to do is chat with your father, and the reason I say that is that you mentioned well over 20 packing plants in Terrebonne.
23 at one time.
Well, that's not published anywhere. So your knowledge tells me that there were 23 groups of individuals, families, if you like.
We can go show you the slabs.
There's also a concrete shrimp drying slab.
Well, believe it or not, where that metal building is next door,
uh-huh.
That was a cannon plant right there. We finished tearing it down next to the concrete. They got a slab on off the water, and from there going to the metal building, we actually got rid of it. It was one of my uncles who was Terrebonne Cannon.
Well,
and that was this was a cannon, and this place started as a cannon. That's what that big warehouse was. They warehoused all the canned fruit shrimp there.
Well, that is.
I mean, it's amazing how many cannon.
It is.
You're talking about the old slab just past my plant, into my pasture, Frisco's dock. Yeah, that was one of the concrete ones put down, and when Frisco, construction guys took over, I hate
right
to see
across the street. That was one of the shrimp drying platforms at one time.
Well, this is common knowledge. But it's not common. And so I'd like to come back, chat with your father, and let's see if we can just let him remember whatever he remembers. Now, what we want to do is we want to make sure you get this for two reasons. It's a courtesy. And at some point, you may have a grandchild that has never heard your daddy's voice.
Well... It was so funny, not my daddy's voice, but just the stories. I have kids right now that really has no interest. I could tell them the story. They don't know They don't know anything about a cannon plant.
But
it's kind of weird.
But at some point in time, when they're a little older,
they're going to have interest.
They're going to, and we're preserving that not for our interest. We're preserving it for your families. And Nicole, I'm sure, will stay on me to make sure. And what we'll do is probably burn a CD and then have her hand deliver it. And it's just the right thing to do, because we're going to lose the stories, and we don't want to lose the stories. But I've been doing this a long time, and about an hour, it's time to say goodnight, because everybody's tired after about an hour. I just love to hear the stories. So I'll get back in touch with Ann. I have your phone number.
I've got to go up that way to check on something. And,
you got my card too, so
I think I know where those labels are. Okay. We moved a bunch of stuff in the house, but I can walk in there either there or not, but it's on the way out. So.
All right. And then next week is Cuckoo. We're one of the things that Nicole is helping us. One of the things that